Hi, this is David Bushman.
And I'm Arthur Smith.
We are the authors of Twin Peaks FAQ, and you are watching Mr. Media.
I'm Bob Andelman, and this is Mr. Media Interview. You can see, hear, and read more than 1,000 of my previous celebrity interviews at MrMedia.com. That's MRMedia.com. Subscribe to the show on YouTube, iTunes, Apple News, Google Play, or Stitcher, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. On today's show, I'll talk to David Bushman and Arthur Smith, co-authors of Twin Peaks FAQ, All That's Left to Know About a Place Both Wonderful and Strange, a thorough guide to frequently and infrequently asked questions about David Lynch's cult TV classic, Twin Peaks, which is returning to television with new episodes on Showtime in early 2017. Stick around. I'm sure we can solve at least one Lynchian mystery today. Can I be honest? I don't think anyone has really asked a lot of questions about the TV series Twin Peaks since the theatrical sequel, Twin Peaks Firewalk With Me, flopped at the movies in 1992. There. I'm glad I got that off my chest. But, that said, my wife and I were big fans of the original run of the TV show on ABC in 1990 and forced ourselves to watch the entire second season, even though it wasn't very good, to be honest. And we skipped Firewalk With Me altogether. And yet, having actually trekked to the rural area of Washington State where the show was filmed, stayed a few nights at the Great Northern, a.k.a. the iconic Salish Lodge and Spa, and visited the astonishing Snoqualmie Falls behind it, we are more than a little curious about the show's impending return with new episodes on Showtime in early 2017. Assuming we aren't the only ones holding out hope of a return to form by the David Lynch and Mark Frost series, I invited David Bushman and Arthur Smith to the show today to talk about their comprehensive new book, Twin Peaks FAQ, All That's Left to Know About a Place Both Wonderful and Strange. David Bushman, Arthur Smith, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thanks, Bob. A pleasure.
Thanks for having us here.
Glad to see you. Thanks for bearing up under the weight of my introduction. I'm sure that there are some people who think that an FAQ about Twin Peaks need not be more than, say, a booklet. So how did you guys fill 367 whole pages?
Well, you know, not to appear argumentative, but there's several things that you said in your intro that I would actually take issue with. One being...
Get ready.
Yeah.
Fire away.
One being the film. I think the film, which was judged very harshly at the time, has withstood the test of time and actually had a lot of people... You scour the internet, and a lot of film critics have reassessed their original position with respect to the film, which I think... surprised a lot of people because it didn't have the humor. It was a lot darker, and it wasn't very much like the TV show, and it didn't have certain characters and certain elements of humor that people had come to associate with the TV show. So I think they were thrown for a loop, and they're a little bit off-put by the darkness of it, but it's an incredibly, incredibly powerful look at this high school girl who is the victim of incest, whether it's, you know, actually her father doing it or not, or some spirit is kind of, whether it's some kind of spirit is a metaphor is one of the mysteries that we look at. But so I think that, and the other thing that I would mention is that, you know, Netflix has increased the audience for Twin Peaks. There's so many shows, take a show like Doctor Who, where BBC, it was nothing in America until it started going on Netflix. Twin Peaks is another show that I think has exposed like whole new generations of viewers. I know I have a daughter who's 23. She knows Twin Peaks. Her friends know Twin Peaks. So it's not just the people who were watching it at the time, but there's whole new generations of viewers. And in terms of the mysteries or frequently asked questions, I think one of the great things about Twin Peaks, which is so rare in television, is that it raised a lot of questions without spelling out the answers for you. It sort of made you think about what the answers were. And then sometimes it even said to you, it doesn't necessarily matter what the answers are. It's more the journey. And I know this is something that Arthur wrote about in the book and that he'd want to talk about that. But there are dozens and dozens and dozens of mysteries about Twin Peaks that were never resolutely resolved. And I think that's part of the fun of it, is trying to it's like that, what is it, Chinese puzzle box that Andrew Packard has, that he's trying to figure out how to open it. I think that's the perfect metaphor, or even the Blue Rose in Fire Walk With Me. These are metaphors for unanswered mysteries. And I think that's just not just Twin Peaks, but I think if you look at David Lynch's work throughout, that's a common thread.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the special pleasures of Twin Peaks is David Lynch's sensibility is that of an abstract artist, at least as much as it is to be a storyteller, and I think probably much more so. He's interested in producing aesthetic effects and dealing with mood and texture, and is just using the narrative conventions of a television serial as one more tool in his paintbox to create a sensation or an effect. And I think that's actually one of the really interesting things about the movie, because the series has its own charm because it has these elements kind of struggling to be contained within a conventional TV narrative. It's in the format of a sort of detective procedural that we're familiar with from decades of television. But when he went on to make the film, he was completely unbound by those conventions. He didn't have to worry about how are we going to pick this up next week, or does this character get a good scene because we need to serve this actor. It just gave the, more abstract and surreal and personal elements of Twin Peaks their full head to just exist, completely free of any sort of restrictions from network television. So I think it's sort of a very distilled, pure hit of Twin Peaks that gets diffused over the course of the series through, continuing storylines and who has a crush on whom and all that sort of stuff. So that's my sort of defense of the movie and why I think the movie is an essential piece of understanding the whole phenomenon of Twin Peaks.
All right, well, you guys are both television curators. I didn't mention this earlier, at the Paley Center for Media in New York, a place that I assume indexes every episode of Mr. Media alongside comedians getting coffee in cars. So, obviously, your opinion matters, and as I'm kissing up here, it matters even more. But, if Twin Peaks rates this kind of treatment, a 367-page FAQ book, I mean, could a book for Jake and the Fat Man be far behind?
You know, I hope so. I hope so. You know, Twin Peaks was a show that was way ahead of its time. I mean, Twin Peaks was a show that, first of all, we make the point in the book, Twin Peaks was art on a medium of commerce, and it was totally ahead of its time because it was a show that shouldn't have required 50 million viewers to stay on the air. Now you take shows like The Sopranos, The Wire, Breaking Bad. These shows have, compared with the audiences that Twin Peaks was even getting in its time during basically a 3-4 network universe, the audiences that these shows are getting are minuscule compared to that. And so even just from a commercial standpoint, Twin Peaks was way ahead of its time. And on top of that, it was unlike anything that I think the one exception was the final episode of The Prisoner. That was the only thing I've ever seen like it. It was surreal. It was artistic. It was it took the conventions of soap operas and dramas and sort of reinvented them. It had a pace that we had never seen on television before. It was beautifully shot. It was artistic is the word I keep coming back to. And you know, I think, first of all, that kind of risk-taking should be celebrated. And I think as television students and historians and scholars, that's partly our job to do that. And you know, maybe it wasn't so recognized in its time for what it was. And I would argue that that's because it was ahead of its time. And it's going to be really interesting to see if it's going to be now of its time or still ahead of its time. And I think my position is that if David Lynch is directing it, which he is, every episode, I think you're going to see something that's still ahead of it, still ahead of the curve. So, you know, I know you're kidding about Jake and the Fat Man, but I think this is really, and you know, so many people have talked about how TV is today's novel. Is it okay to write a 367-page book on what? What's an example? Well, The Great Gatsby, or
no, I mean, look at Infinite Jest. It's about a video of watching a pleasurable video that kills you, and it's a 1,000-page fascinating book. But I think what that has in common with Twin Peaks is Twin Peaks was a fully postmodern piece of art, and I think unprecedented on television, and so rich with allusion and metatextual reference and commentary on the medium in which it existed and tying to sort of primal Freudian ideas. It's just so rich with the sort of delicious, academic, obsessive, endlessly debatable, fun arguments to have. It's infinitely full of unanswered questions that are, I think, infinitely fruitful to consider and argue about, and are a way to understand the show itself and its relationship to other shows and to storytelling in general. It's just a kaleidoscopic sort of what am I trying to say?
Artwork.
It's a cornucopia. It's a cornucopia of things to wonder about, think about, argue about, be confused by, and reflect on.
Two things I would just add to that is that, number one, I agree with everything that Arthur said, but the book, the approach that we take in our book is in no way academic or dry. It's very accessible. And number two, again, agreeing with everything that Arthur just said, the other thing about Twin Peaks that I think he didn't mention perhaps is that, and this is especially true of the movie, this is a incredibly powerful programming or film on an emotional level as well, on a character level and on an emotional level. And I mean, anyone who watches that show and that movie and doesn't feel for someone like Laura Palmer is a very hard person, you know? I mean, so it resonates on all these levels that these sort of intellectual and aesthetic and emotional levels, but also just as a powerful drama about characters who we care about and we feel for and who go through some difficult times. And I think the mystery, the great mystery at the core of Twin Peaks is not who killed Laura Palmer, but really what is Bob and what is the nature of evil. And that, I mean, come on, Bob, we've got two Bobs here. You know, philosophers have been writing tomes about that are a lot longer than 367 pages, but here, you know, Lynch and Mark Frost did it in a way that was totally gripping and dramatically compelling and accessible. So it's just fascinating on so many levels.
My perception over the years had been that the original season of Twin Peaks was intended as a one season show. Am I wrong in that? Over the years, have I twisted that? Because, and the reason I've always thought that was that the sense I always had was that Lynch and Frost didn't always have a plan for a second season. And then once the show became a hit, there's pressure. Hey, we got to come back and we got to do it again. And it's like, oh well, you know. And it didn't really go. The second season didn't go as smoothly as the first because maybe it was an afterthought.
Well, it never was considered just a one season show. But there were things that happened, like. They had every episode of the first season was in the can, was written, shot, edited, produced before a single episode aired. So the first season, they had a lot of time. They didn't have to deal with critical backlash. They didn't have to deal with network backlash, with viewer backlash. Mark Frost has called it working in splendid isolation. In the second season, it was a lot more your traditional way of trying to churn out 29 altogether, so whatever it was, 22 episodes on a weekly basis, and now you're getting all the feedback from the critics who are complaining that Laura's murder hasn't been solved, and you're getting network executives who are getting nervous about the fact that viewers are leaving, and suddenly everything changed, and then there were all sorts of weird, unpredictable things happening, like I don't know if you've heard this story. They were planning to have a romance between Cooper and Audrey Horn, but conventional wisdom or traditional wisdom is that Lara Flynn Boyle, who played Donna Hayward and was Kyle MacLachlan's girlfriend at the time in real life, said, no, that's not going to happen. So they had to rejuggle storylines. And so there were so many things kind of, coalescing against them in the second season that made it difficult in a way that is like legendary at this point, you know?
Lynch got busy with other stuff as well.
And so did Mark Frost. And he was doing Storyville.
They both had a less direct input into the show at that point.
Can I put in a vote that Sherilyn Fenn on the most recent season of Shameless on Showtime, for me, was actually the third season of Twin Peaks, and then this upcoming will be the fourth season. It was kind of like Star Wars Rogue One, where we're going to tell you a separate story using a similar character, because that shows a completely different taste, but it's just as insane as anything I've ever seen on Twin Peaks. I'd just like to...
Or you could say Mulholland Drive was season three, as that was originally conceived as a vehicle for Sherilyn Fenn's character, a spinoff. So she sort of exists in that to some degree, too.
But I think that's an interesting point that you make, because you notice they're both Showtime shows, and I think that really is, you know, HBO has the prestige drama, and it's not TV, it's HBO. I really think the mood that you described or the aesthetic that you described is exactly how Showtime is trying to define itself. So Shameless fits there, and Twin Peaks fits there. And I think that's an interesting insight that you had.
Wow, see, I'm not all bad, guys.
But, you know, I forget the guy who does Shameless, but I'm going to sound like I am in awe of David Lynch. And as a film director, I really am. And I don't think there's anybody quite like him. So I think that I'm expecting – a lot of people said, should Twin Peaks have ended after one season or after two seasons? I can't wait for season three. I think it's going to be fantastic.
So the sense I'm getting is this wasn't just a paying gig for you guys to write this book. You actually – you enjoy this. This is – you're both very into Twin Peaks.
Yeah, and Lynch too. I think we're both long-time fans. We're both serious movie fans, and Lynch is a particular favorite for both of us. And, this is something we definitely both sincerely love. We loved it when it originally aired. We were both very fascinated by it. And it's never really left our imagination since.
You know, I've been having this weird Twin Peaks confluence on Mr. Media this past week, starting with an interview last week with Charlotte Stewart, David Lynch's favorite. She played Mary X in Eraserhead, and then Betty Briggs on Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
So chatted with her. And then a few days ago, I talked to a guy named Bill Plimpton, who is a film director, mostly known as an animator, but he has a new film this week called Hitler's Folly. Right. Yeah. Starring Dana Ashbrook, who was Bobby Briggs on Twin Peaks. So,
yeah, right.
and now you guys. So, and right. Actually, your book arrived the morning that I interviewed Charlotte Stewart, so I got to read her entry in your book.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
So, how did she react?
She was thrilled. She was glad to be in it.
That's really cool that you did that. Thank you.
Yeah, we like her a lot.
My pleasure. That'll post – well, everything is – time is out of sequence here, but that'll post just ahead of your interview. So
it's appropriate.
So is the universe sending me a message or what? That's what I really want to know.
Yeah, the message is to watch Twin Peaks and read the book.
I read the book.
Oh, well, then you're paying attention to the message. It is very Twin Peaksian, you're right. I mean, are you seeing a lot of owls?
I don't know. It's so weird because I've been doing this show. This is the 10th year of doing Mr. Media. I've never had anything came up that was even remotely related to Twin Peaks. And in the last week, it's very weird. Although I will tell you that I looked at the call list for the new series, and there are five people among those 200 some actors who have been on Mr. Media. So I will be retreading Patrick Fischler. Hell is Gilman's? I can't think of his first name. Ethan Suplee, Charlene Yee, and Madeline Zima.
So that's clearly David Lynch is watching you.
Apparently. Well, and a lot of these five, I think of them, three or four of them have all been popped up on Showtime series. So I think what you're saying is true. Madeline Zima, if you don't know the name, Californication. She is the young girl in the very first episode who David Duchovny gets involved with and inspires the book that becomes, pardon my French, Punching and Fucking. And is an ongoing thread. Anyway, And Patrick Fischler.
Has that great scene in Mulholland Drive where they go behind the restaurant, one of the most terrifying sequences in the history of film.
Also was in Californication and...
Mad Men?
In Mad Men. I'm just trying to think what else on Showtime he was on. But yeah, I mean, it just seems, you know...
Coffee, of course, is in Twin Peaks.
That's right.
Small world, right?
An early respectful portrayal of a transgender person on network television, really.
Do you worry at all with a call? I mean, they revealed the call sheet with all those names on it. Do you worry at all that it's some of that is stunt casting and there's going to be too many cameos that will take away from what's actually going on in the story?
So, you know, again, to me, Bob, this comes back to what I said before. I have tremendous faith and confidence that David Lynch and Mark Frost are going to do right by this series. I mean, I think they're both, this is what I say about David Lynch, and I don't mean to diminish Mark Frost's contribution, because we talk about that too, and what Mark Frost did was essential. But for me, Lynch at his best is amazing, and at his worst is interesting. And I'll take either one.
How do you explain the difference between what each of them brings to the show?
Well, I think this might be kind of reductive, but I think Mark Frost kind of does the stuff that makes it work as a TV show. I think the sort of plotting, the rapid-fire dialogue, a lot of the kind of quirky, humorous aspects of the show, and just a lot of the more structural things. The idea of the lodges came from his interest in theosophy. So I think... what Mark Frost provided was the skeleton for the show to stand upright and walk and work and function as a narrative that was going to make some degree of sense and give the audience a way in episode after episode, where David Lynch contributed really the vision, the artistic, surreal, abstract... values, and I think also it's my feeling that he has a very sort of direct primal conduit to these sort of inchoate emotions and deep drives that we have as human beings, and he's able to marshal sound and image in a way that hits us right in those places, that sort of bypasses rational thought. And I think it's that sort of secret X factor element that makes the show really a work of art and genius. I think it wouldn't have worked as a show without Frost. It would have been maybe Fire Walk With Me week after week, and that just would not make any sense in the context of a continuing television show.
Also,
but I think they're both necessary. Absolutely necessary, equally necessary to make Twin Peaks the, you know, specifically compelling, charming, entertaining, funny, weird, disturbing entertainment that it is.
Yeah, kind of like me and Arthur, but...
Bada bing!
Another amazing thing about Twin Peaks is, if you think about it, and Arthur was describing Lynch's motivation and the sort of primal nature of what he does, I think he at one point said... something like 50 to 75% of the mythology of Twin Peaks, it all just sort of came to him instinctively. The entire thing with Bob and the Red Room and the man, you know, the man from another place, the dancing dwarf they call him, that all came to him. It was just instinctive. He had to come up with an ending for the pilot in order to make a closed-end version for video distribution in Europe. He had already shot everything. Someone reminded him he had to do this. I think he was in the parking lot one day, and he describes that he put his hand on the car. The car was really hot, and he had this vision of this red room and this dancing dwarf and Bob and all of this. And then the other story that's been told is that the guy who played Bob, Frank Silva, was the set dresser on that show, and he had sort of blockaded himself in Laura Palmer's bedroom. And somebody shouted out, "Bob, you got to get out of there!" And Lynch gets a vision in his head that of Frank down crouching down by Laura's bed, and it becomes like the defining philosophical mystery of the show. And these things just came to him almost like dreams or like instincts. And
it's intuitive. It's completely intuitive.
And I don't think you can say that about anything else, any other show that's ever been. I mean, these are not just, you know, throwaway lines or something. This is the core of the show, more or less, that was just these visions that he had.
Even accidents on set, like you talked about with Frank Civil, who plays Bob, or
the flicking light.
One of the major visual motifs of the show is flickering lights. And that originated with a scene where the fluorescent over Laura Palmer's dead body in the examining room was just legitimately flickering. And Lynch, I guess that's what an artist does. It was unplanned, it was an accident, but he saw that it gave the scene this whole added dimension of tension and mystery and atmosphere, and kept it in and went on to repeat it and use it as sort of an echoing motif to signify unease or perhaps movement in the dark spirit world or whatever. But the point is, these are very unconventional ways of making something like a television show, where the economics and logistics demand that you have an extremely streamlined piece of machinery where there are no extraneous parts. Anything that is introduced or mentioned or made note of is going to pay off down the line in a very rational way, because there's just not time to goof around and follow your imagination or integrate a weird mistake because you like the effect it makes. But that's exactly the approach that Lynch took with this show, and the results speak for themselves.
So I'd like to give you guys a minute to talk directly to people who are big Twin Peaks fans and are wondering what can they get out of this book that they don't already know or understand about Twin Peaks.
Well, I mean, we can both address that. Number one, I'd say it's just a fun read. You'll laugh a lot. I think that you'll certainly get caught up on in things and have your memory jarred. I think there's also some really, really interesting deconstructions of the mythology and mysteries that we've talked about that kind of looks at all the possible explanations for them and the sort of meaning of them, what they mean, how different people have deconstructed them over the years. So I think it's also provocative in that way. It's, you know, sort of thought-provoking. So it's funny, it's informative, it's provocative. That would be what I would say about it.
Yeah, and I'd say I think the format of the book or the title, it might create the impression that this is sort of a trivia compendium or something, where you're just getting lots of lists or sort of the dry facts of what happened when. And you can read the book, and the information about how the show was created and produced and the history of the network, all that stuff is in there. But like David said, it's hopefully done in an engaging and funny and flavorful way. But more than that, you know, I've grown up being an obsessive fan of lots of things, and I would always love any kind of supplementary material that sort of deepened my engagement with the thing itself. Like an example I think of, this is a very nerdy one, is the official handbook of the Marvel Universe came out in the 80s, in which they took all the characters that you knew and in a sort of encyclopedia format broke down their biography, what their abilities were, what their personality was like, what they looked like. And it was stuff that as a fan, you know, you love these characters so much. It's kind of thrilling to see them distilled and summarized in a way that evokes that thing that you love about them. Like, yeah, that's what makes this thing cool. This is why I like to read about this guy. And so I think that's the sort of approach we tried to take with each element of the show that we're covering. We don't just want to give you a character breakdown with the actor and the major plot events they're involved in. We want to give you a sense of what that person is like, what their life might be like, what their relationships with are like with other people on the show. And we hope it's a way to sort of find things to resonate with your feelings about the show, things for you to argue with, things for you to take issue with, invitation for you to think deeper about some things, but I think really our aim was wanting to have that sort of feeling like you're talking to your new best friend, freshman year of college, late at night in your dorm room, and you're having the most mind-blowing, fun, deep conversation about a thing you both love. I think that's the tone we were trying to hit with this thing.
Why do you guys think that Northern Exposure endured in all its unique and wonderful quirkiness so much longer than Twin Peaks did?
I think that's another show that actually, I think it did endure longer, but it also, I think by the time it had burned out, I think there was a pretty significant backlash against it. So I think, you know, quirkiness is a hard thing to maintain. You know,
Also, they never had to come back from a scene where Hollis brutally murders Shelley in his living for 9 minutes in excruciating, terrible detail.
But he thought about it. We know that. He thought about it.
Come on, Bob. We all thought about it.
But, you know, it was a much more conventional show. I mean, like I said, the pacing of Twin Peaks, everything about it was unconventional. I mean, you took what Lynch and Frost did was they took the conventions of generic television and reshaped them, redefined them in a way that was challenging, I think, to viewers. And I think in today's universe of broadcast television, they couldn't get away with that. And I think it made a lot of demands on the viewer that at a certain point, like Lynch and Frost, they didn't see this as a murder mystery. I did so much research. Critics would not stop asking him, when are you gonna tell us who killed Laura? That's all they wanted to know about. And Lynch and Frost didn't even care about that. I mean, Lynch compared it to The Fugitive sure, everybody thinks about the last episode of The Fugitive where they find the one-armed man, but every week it wasn't about who killed the wife or where the one-armed man was. It was these human interest stories.
But that's the thing. People who do really get and love Twin Peaks, I think it's because of that demand put on them as a viewer. I think having to do work, you're seduced by the thing, so you want to do the work. But doing the work, I think, deepens your engagement with the work.
Right, but I just think in the universe that it was airing in the 90s, there weren't enough people to make it viable longer. And I totally agree with you. That's why I think it's great now where you don't need that size of an audience.
I mean, in some ways, Northern Exposure took a lot of the distinctive elements of Twin Peaks and made it palatable to a more traditional TV audience by taking away anything that would challenge or really confuse you and just leaving the things that would delight you. So it was kind of a candy move in that sense, and I guess it worked.
I'll just point out for anyone watching this who likes Northern Exposure that Rob Morrow, at different times, Rob Morrow and Paul Provenza, or as he calls himself, the man who killed Northern Exposure, have both been on this show, and you can search the archive for those interviews.
I like Northern Exposure.
Yeah.
I love Northern Exposure. And I mentioned at the top that my wife and I went to Snoqualmie and stayed a few days at the Salish Lodge. We also went to Roslyn and visited the set of Northern Exposure at the time. It was probably 2 or 3 years after the show ended its run. Or maybe it was during. Anyway.
Waterfalls are amazing, though, aren't they? The Snoqualmie Waterfall.
Oh, the whole area is spectacular.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so last question, guys, and you've been great with your time. After the Showtime episodes air, will there be a quick update to the Twin Peaks FAQ?
We hope so. I mean, we'd certainly like to do that. And, there's going to be a lot to write about. And, you know, that would certainly be our intention. We haven't discussed it yet with our publisher, but that's certainly in our minds.
Good. So,
yeah, I guess we'll see if the show connects like it did the first time around. I really hope so.
Yeah.
Well, I'll hope for your sake that it does, so you get another shot at the ring here.
So are you planning to watch it?
Oh, of course.
Okay, because you said you gave up on it, right?
Well, but we watched the whole first and second season. We just didn't watch, as I put it, we endured the second season. We have not watched the movie, but I'm sure we will at least go back and watch the first season and probably watch the movie. I don't know that I can bring myself to watch the second season a second time.
Watch the last third.
First and the first third.
Yeah.
The first third is the whole resolution of the Laura Palmer arc.
All right. And that's probably good advice to people watching this as to how to approach it. Go watch the first season, watch at least the first third of the second season, the last third of the second season, and watch the movie, because obviously you guys are fond of the movie.
Right.
Most amazing series finale in the history of TV. Just right. Mind-boggling.
Okay. Folks, listen, you can order David Buschman and Arthur Smith's new book, Twin Peaks FAQ, All That's Left to Know About a Place Both Wonderful and Strange, from great retailers everywhere, or get it right now at a great price from MrMedia.com. If you're watching this, there's a lot of places you could be watching this. If you're watching this on MrMedia.com, just below the video, you'll see the cover of the book. You can click on it. You can download, I'm sure, as an ebook, or you can order the physical copy. You can have it in a day or two from Amazon. So do that. Guys, do you have is there a website for the book? Is there any Twitter, Facebook, any social media?
There is a Twitter account, which is Twin Peaks FAQ. There's an email account. You can certainly email us at twinpeaksfaq@gmail.com. We are writing stuff for the Applause Backwing website. We've put some pieces up there. We've got some more coming up. So there's plenty of ways to get in touch with us, and we'd love to hear, you know, from everybody. In fact, we sort of encourage people to tweet or email us with the mysteries that they think are the most vexing about Twin Peaks, and they might get a free book out of that.
Cool. All right. Well, David Buschman, Arthur Smith, thank you both so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Well, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you for having us.
Is recorded live before a studio audience full of mystery buffs who think that solving who killed Laura Palmer and even J.R. Ewing is more important than enjoying a simple hour of popcorn TV in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida.
Letterman used to say, send it right off to the broadcast museum.